This is day three at the 49th New Zealand Christadelphian Bible School. Our first period speaker is Brother Mark Vincent on exploring the Psalms. This is the third talk in his series. The subtitle for today is Psalms of Sorrow. The introductory reading is Psalm 70. Brother Mark.
Well, good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
It's starting to get a bit complicated, isn't it, juggling all the bits of paper, so I apologise for that. You might remember we didn't quite get finished yesterday with our Psalms of Creation and Praise, so there's one more, just because I really like it, but we're going to indulge in the speaker's privilege of looking at that. So page 3 of your handout, actually, from yesterday, and it's Psalm 67. So it's on page 3, and again, we're going to be doing some drawing on the sheet. If you've if you do have your sheet to hand, that would be great. So one last psalm of praise before we come to the Psalms of Sorrow. So let's just have a look, just scan the psalm to yourself for a moment, and you'll notice that it has a refrain in it. Can anybody tell me what it is? Let the people praise thee, O God. Let all the people praise thee. So we might want to start by just putting a box around the refrain, around both occurrences of it. So that's lines... What is it, lines 5 and 6? And then where it occurs later on in the psalm, let the people praise thee, O God, let all the people praise thee. So that's a clue then, isn't it, of what this psalm is going to be about. This psalm is about all people praising God. And it's not something that they're doing at the moment, necessarily. It's something that the psalm is encouraging them to do. Let this be the case. May this happen. Might not be happening now, but let it happen as soon as possible. And that we talked about imperatives yesterday, didn't we? Well, that's a command word, praise the Lord. Well, this one's a little bit different, this let. This is called a jussive. We won't get too hung up about that, but that's what it is. Let the people praise thee, O God. Let all the people praise thee. Now, what I'd like to do now is notice something about the pronouns that are used in the psalm. And I'd like you to notice how the psalm begins. God be merciful unto us and bless us. And again, just look through the psalm, and if you just want to circle all the times it says us. How many did you get? Five. And what do you notice about where they appear in the psalm? They're at the beginning and they're at the end. And there's none in the middle, is there? So we're becoming familiar with this sort of pattern, aren't we? Because we've seen it and we've started to see it in a lot of psalms now, this connection between the beginning and the end of the psalm. All the us's are at the beginning and at the end. So do you notice then what we have is that we, the speakers of this psalm, the singers of this psalm, we are the frame of this psalm, aren't we? We're the thing that holds this psalm together, that surrounds it, and that embraces it, as it were. Now, what is it that we embrace? Well, let's look in the middle now, and I'd like you to perhaps underline, or some different way of marking off, underline everything that is to do with the people, the nations, the earth. Now, what do you notice about that? It's every single line, isn't it? Isn't that remarkable? Every single line. Apart from the lines that have got us in. Now, there's one exception to that, and it's right at the end of the psalm. Let's just imagine that exception doesn't exist for a minute, because we'll talk about that later on. But ignoring that exception, what we have is the first two lines are about us, and then every line in the middle, every single line is about the nations, the people, the earth, and then there's two lines at the end that are about us again. So do you see how in this psalm we are embracing the nations, the people, the creation, aren't we? And what this psalm is, it's a little microcosm of God's whole purpose. How is it that God is going to reconcile the world to himself? How is it that there is going to be harmony and unity, and that all the earth will be filled with God's glory? How is that going to be? It's going to be through us, isn't it? God is going to use us to facilitate that, to enable that to be the case. And of course, not because of what we are in ourselves, not because we're so great, but because of what God will accomplish through us, using us as his tools, using us as his children, the Lord Jesus Christ being our forerunner. So this psalm, you know, you wouldn't think of this as a psalm to as a preaching text, would you? You know, as a as a statement of the purpose of God, and yet it kind of is. It is that. It's just in those few verses of this little brief psalm, there is this encapsulation of the whole of God's purpose to reconcile all things to himself, whether things in heaven or things in earth. So let's take a closer look. God be merciful to us and bless us and cause his face to shine upon us. And then we pause and we think about that. So why should we want that? Why should we pray that God would bless us? Well, is it just, you know, well, we like to be blessed. I mean, it's good to be blessed, isn't it? It's good to get stuff. Well, it can't be that, can it? There must be more to it than that. And indeed, there is. And the very next line explains that with that little word, that. In order that, this is why we want God to bless us, in order that thy way, God's way, may be known upon earth. Thy saving health among all nations. So we know how it was that God's purpose was to function with Israel in Old Testament times, wasn't it? That by God's people Israel obeying his laws and putting them into practice, God would bless them, and the other nations around would see how God was blessing them and would say, we want some of what you've got. We can see that you're different, that you're special, that you have these unique laws, that God is blessing you. Tell us more about it. Can we come along and join up as well? That was God's purpose, wasn't it? And the flip side of that was that if they failed to obey God's commands, they would suffer in various ways, Deuteronomy 28, and that they would become a sign, actually, to the other nations. But really, this psalm is focusing on the positive, that Israel were to be a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. And in that sense, they would mediate or facilitate God's revelation of himself and wouldn't sort of keep it to themselves. Isn't it great that we've got this? But they would be the mechanism through which it would be promulgated through the whole earth. Now, isn't it interesting then that those two lines contain an allusion, don't they? God be merciful to us and bless us and cause his face to shine upon us. Where does that come from? It's the priestly blessing, isn't it? And we sang it yesterday, because we were meant to talk about this psalm yesterday, when we sang, the Lord bless thee and keep thee, and cause his face to shine upon thee and give thee peace. This was the priestly blessing. And so how appropriate then that the psalm should quote that and say, Lord, bless us with that priestly blessing so that we may be that kingdom of priests and a holy nation that you have called us to be, so that we may facilitate your name being known throughout the world. And so this psalm then speaks about Israel's national role as God's witnesses. But it speaks about more than that, doesn't it? Because the Apostle Peter tells us that now we are called to be a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. And so that we should pray the priestly blessing for ourselves, as we sang yesterday. The Lord bless thee and keep thee. And we all sang it to each other, didn't we? Why? Why do we want that blessing? That thy way may be known upon earth, thy saving health among all nations. That's God's purpose and we long for the fulfillment of it. And it will be realized, of course, primarily through the work of the Lord Jesus Christ, but not just through his work, through our work too, as priests and ministers of his. And all that is spoken about in this beautiful psalm. And then, it steps forward in this refrain to the time when that would be the case. Let the people praise thee, O God. Let all the people praise thee. O let the nations be glad and sing for joy, for thou shalt judge the people righteously and govern the nations upon earth. Let the people praise thee, O God. Let all the people praise thee. Then shall the earth yield her increase. So we step forward now to the kingdom when these things are being accomplished, and you know, we think of all the fruitfulness of the earth that there is today and think that that fruitfulness is what comes from the earth when it's under a curse. And we can only begin to imagine what it's going to be like when that veil is taken away, when that curse is lifted, and the fullness of the fruitfulness that God can bring forth is made known in the earth. Then shall the earth yield her increase, and God, even our own God, shall bless us. Thinking then about our work as saints in the kingdom, God shall bless us, and all the ends of the earth shall fear him. And that's the exception then, isn't it? The exception at the end of the psalm brings us all together, doesn't it? It brings us and them. It brings us, the saints, and them, all the nations of the earth who are not believers currently, but who in that day will finally come to recognize their Lord and their King. This is God's great purpose enshrined in these few verses of this psalm in such a beautiful way. Time now then for today's main topic, which is the Psalms of Sorrow. Now, we can think of the book of Psalms in a way as being like a pendulum, you know, which swings from these psalms of joy and praise that we've been considering yesterday and thus far today to psalms that are really quite different at the other extreme, aren't they? Psalms of lament and sorrow. And the emotions that are expressed in both of these psalms are strong. You can feel the blood pumping through the veins, can't you, in these psalms. Whether it's in joyful expressions of praise or whether it's in cries of despair and sorrow. And, you know, it's worth making a point about that, isn't it? That, you know, these are living, breathing poems, psalms. I'm struggling to find the right word to use. There's nothing flat about this, is there? This is people who are alive, who are really experiencing the ups and downs that come in life. And so in some ways, does it make you wonder a bit if our lives have just got a bit too normal now, a bit too all the same, a bit too automatic, a bit too comfortable, so that we neither experience the highs of joy that the Psalms express, nor the lows, the anguish, perhaps. I read one writer once who was making the comparison between the Psalms as prayers and the kinds of prayers that we might offer ourselves, whether communal prayers or whether our own personal prayers. And this writer, who wasn't a Christadelphian, so he was just talking about, you know, I don't know what congregation it was that he belonged to, but he was saying that a lot of prayers that he heard today struck him as being weak and anemic prayer. And I sort of know what he means by that. Prayer that sort of says the right words, but how much real feeling and emotion is in there. And to some extent, again, perhaps it's the lifestyle that we lead. You know, we've probably not personally experienced being exploited. I mean, we have to pay our taxes, and that may annoy us. But you know, it's not like we're Naboth's family, is it? And have experienced what it means for someone to completely abuse us and manipulate us and take something that they have no right to take, and that we've been completely powerless to do anything about it. We probably haven't experienced that. Most of us have probably not experienced direct persecution. You know, we're aware about the miscarriages of justice that go on in the world. We're aware of wars and struggles of different types, but they may not have personally affected our lives. And so those things can sort of wash over us and we just become somehow numb to it. Whereas in the Psalms, these things are being personally felt and experienced. And so we get to live that with the psalmist, and we can be helpful to think about what it was like for them experiencing those things. And it can be helpful for us also that these psalms can help us enter into the sufferings of our brothers and sisters in different parts of the world who do experience such things. And then perhaps to a lesser extent, we can think about how they apply in our own lives as well. There's a tendency for us to rely on ourselves when things go bad, isn't there? And to congratulate ourselves when things go well. But the Psalms don't allow us to do that. When things go bad for the psalmist, he's powerless of himself to do anything about it. He doesn't have some huge insurance policy that's going to bail him out, for example, of this situation that's happened. And so he turns to God, because God is the only one who can help him. And when things go well, he doesn't see it as, well, this is just a reflection of, you know, I studied really hard when I was in college, and therefore I have this coming to me, and I have some entitlement to the things that I have, or any measure of success that may have come. He doesn't see it like that at all. It's all God. So everything that happens in his life then, he sees in relation to God. And that's a very interesting thing, and I think it's something that we can learn a lot from. That was the focus, his relationship with God, and when things go wrong, that threatens the relationship with God. And that's why you bring it to God in prayer. You know, not just because you feel sorry for yourself, but because it's having an impact on the most important relationship that you have. And similarly, when things go well, what would you want to do but dance before the Lord as David danced? Because you're so grateful at his goodness in your life. So if we think about this pendulum then, from joy or praise to lament, something like a third of the Psalms we might classify as being Psalms of praise, Psalms of joy, and something like a half, so significantly more of the Psalms, something like a half of the book of Psalms consists of these Psalms of lament. And one of the things that's very interesting about these lament psalms is that they seem to have a pattern to them. So some very direct things are expressed in these prayers, and sometimes we might read them and think, is that right to be saying that to God? You know, that seems very forthright. I wouldn't dare say that, something like that, to God in my own prayer. And yet the psalmists are there saying it in what is an inspired scriptural account. So I take it that these psalms are put into the scriptures for us and inspired by God to indicate to us that these are the sorts of prayers that it is okay for us to pray. So there may be times of doubt in our lives when we come to doubt whether and when, you know, God is really going to fulfill his promises. Sometimes where we might even begin to wonder whether he's even there, whether he really cares, and how he could allow this to happen if he does care. And we might try and repress those thoughts and think that we ought not to feel them. Now, from a theoretical perspective, of course, it would be better if we didn't, wouldn't it? You know, it'd be better if we never had any doubts. It'd be better if our faith was always, you know, you imagine a faith gauge like a speedometer, and you imagine it was always at 100%. But, of course, we know that that's not true, isn't it? We fluctuate, we change constantly by the things that are, you know, things that are going on in our lives. You know, while in theory it might be better never to feel doubt, never to question, the fact is that we do. And what these psalms are showing us is that when we do, we should talk to God about it. We shouldn't bottle it up or hide it away or pretend it isn't there. We should actually tell him. And tell him in no uncertain terms. And yet, as we do that, there's another side to it. Because we can take these examples of the psalmist saying some very direct and seemingly extreme things to God, and we could start to conclude from that then, well, I can just say anything. I can just say whatever I like, no matter how angry I feel or how upset I feel. I can just say that to God. And to a certain extent, that is true, and yet the very way these psalms are constructed, in example after example after example, shows us that there is a yes but about that. Yes, we can and should be honest and open with God, but we must do so in a principled way. Let's look into that, and then hopefully you'll see what I mean. Now, in virtually every psalm of lament, or perhaps we should rephrase that as in most psalms of lament, you can find three elements. Now, you can sometimes find other elements as well, but you will almost always find these three elements. And we can name them like this. Complaint. Well, we know what a complaint is. My shredded wheat had a piece of plastic in it. You know, that's a complaint, isn't it? There's something wrong which is upsetting me, which isn't what I feel it ought to be like. There's a problem, an expression of the problem. That's the complaint. That's the first stage. Then there's a plea. The plea is what we would like God to do about it, how we would like God to help us. And the third part is an expression of confidence. Complaint, plea, and confidence. Let's take a look at an example, and it's the one on page 4 of your handout, Psalm 13. So just have a read through the psalm and have a think about which bit do you think is the complaint. First four lines, right? So let's just have to think about that, first of all. Now, there's an obvious connection between the first four lines. What is it? How long? How long? How long? How long? So the psalmist is frustrated by God's seeming inaction, isn't he? He feels forgotten. He feels ignored. He feels uncertain. He feels sad. He feels humiliated. And he tells God that that is how he feels. How long wilt thou forget me, O Lord? Forever? How long wilt thou hide thy face from me? How long shall I take counsel in my soul, having sorrow in my heart daily? How long shall my enemy be exalted over me? Pretty direct, isn't it? He's not mincing his words here about how he feels. What about the plea then? What do you think, which part constitutes the plea? The next four lines. Yeah, the next four lines. Consider. So here we've got an imperative now, haven't we? A command word. Consider me, O Lord. Consider and hear me, O Lord, my God. Lighten my eyes, lest I sleep the sleep of death. Lest mine enemy say, I have prevailed against him, and those that trouble me rejoice when I am moved. So really, this is a plea for God to pay attention, to listen, and by implication to act, having listened, isn't it? To lighten his eyes, to lift the burden, to lift the cloud of doom that seems to be hanging over him, that weight that seems to press down upon him. To not allow the enemy, presumably the wicked, the unbelievers, to prosper over him. And finally, we have the expression of confidence. But I have trusted in thy mercy. My heart shall rejoice in thy salvation. I will sing unto the Lord, because he hath dealt bountifully with me. Now, do you see, there's something almost paradoxical about those two lines. They don't seem to fit the mood of the rest of the psalm, do they? But this is exactly what we find time after time after time in these lament psalms. That having expressed the complaint and the plea in those direct terms, the psalmist then goes on to say, nevertheless, Lord, I know you are there, I know you do care, and I know your plan will be established and you will do something about it. And this is what we mean when we say there's something very principled about how the laments take place.
They tell God about the problem, but they also reassert the faith that they have. Now think again about that, you know, that speedometer of your faith. And so, you know, you'd like it to be 100, and here it is right now, though, and it's only at 40%. So you have all these doubts, you have 60% of doubts, as it were, and you tell God about those doubts. But then what you must do is tell him also about the 40% of faith that's remaining, that's still there. So, now, of course, if the faith dial were right at zero, and you no longer believed in God at all, well, there'd be no point in even offering the prayer in the first place, would there? Because you wouldn't even believe that there was anyone that you were praying to. So the point here is that, so if you have enough faith left to offer a prayer, then tell God about that faith that you have. And that's what the Psalms do again and again. So this is the structure to it then, that yes, God allows us to tell him of our problems, to tell him of the frustrations that we feel. But he requires of us also that we also tell him of the confidence that we have in him, of the faith that is left, of what we still know to be true in our heart of hearts, although it seems and feels otherwise right now. So we've picked this psalm. This is a very simple example. It's very clear here, isn't it? That threefold breakdown into the complaint, the plea, and the confidence. Now, most of the lament psalms are not quite as simple as that. You know, you might get a bit of complaint, and then you may have something else, and then the complaint may come back again. The elements may be mixed up. There may be other bits that aren't those three things. But usually, you will find that somewhere in the psalm that each of those three things can be found in some form or other. And actually, this isn't just the Psalms. Let's just very quickly look at Isaiah 37. So this is the prayer that King Hezekiah offers when Sennacherib has surrounded the city. And he takes the letter of the Rabshakeh and spreads it out before the Lord. And this is what he says, Isaiah 37 and verse 15. And Hezekiah prayed unto the Lord, saying, O Lord of hosts, God of Israel, that dwellest between the cherubims, thou art the God, even thou alone of all the kingdoms of the earth, thou hast made heaven and earth. Now, what do you think that is? Is that the plea, the complaint, or the confidence? It's the confidence, isn't it? So Hezekiah flips the order around, and he begins with the expression of confidence. So this is why he's bringing this prayer to God, because that's who he believes God is. And if that's who you believe that God is, then tell him that. That seems to be the message here that's coming out from this pattern being here again and again in the Psalms. What about the next bit then? Incline thine ear, O Lord, and hear, and open thine eyes, O Lord, and see, and hear all the words of Sennacherib, which hath sent to reproach the living God. What is that? That's the plea, isn't it? That's what he wants God to do about it. Of a truth, Lord, the kings of Assyria have laid waste all the nations and their countries, and have cast their gods into the fire, for they were no gods, but the work of men's hands, wood and stone. Therefore they have destroyed them. Now therefore, what is that bit that we've just read? That's the complaint, isn't it? Now therefore, O Lord our God, save us from his hand, that all the kingdoms of the earth may know that thou art the Lord, even thou only. And then we've got a plea element coming in again, haven't we? But you see, you've got exactly the same three elements there in the prayer of Hezekiah. Well, let's turn to another psalm, and why don't we look at Psalm 142. Now, in this one, there are each of these elements, they're sort of all over the place in this psalm. There's not a clear structure here at all. Let's just have a look at the psalm, nevertheless, and see what we can learn from it. I cried unto the Lord with my voice unto the Lord did I make supplication. I poured out my complaint or my anxiety. Well, it even tells us what it is there, doesn't it? I poured out my complaint or my anxiety before him. I showed before him my trouble. When my spirit was overwhelmed within me, then thou knewest my path. So we've got elements of perhaps even of depression here, don't we? Of this anxiety, of this trouble, of his spirit being overwhelmed as if it's just too much to cope with. He can't cope. He can't deal with the situation that he's in. What situation is that? Well, actually, there's a little superscription to the psalm, isn't there, that gives us a clue about that. A prayer of Maskell of David, a prayer when he was in the cave. So this is when David was being chased by Saul and was fleeing for his life. And perhaps at the beginning of that experience, when he first realized that was the case, that these were the new rules of his life, that he was now, after having been the giant slayer and the national hero, that he was now the fugitive, the one that the king wanted to slay above all. Similarly, if you look at the fourth line from the bottom, attend to my cry, for I am brought very low. Deliver me from my persecutors, for they are stronger than I. Bring my soul out of prison. This is desperate language, isn't it? And you think of him being in the cave, being hedged in, being fenced in and surrounded by the enemies of Saul, who are going through cave after cave, trying to find the one that David is hiding in. And the walls of the cave, made of rock, and he wants to break out of that, of those oppressive armies that are hedging him in. And of course you can't, can you? You bang your fist against the rock and all you do is break your fist. There's nothing he can do of himself to escape here. The walls of the cave are his prison, as it were, when he says, bring my soul out of prison. Let's carry on reading. We got, I think, to line 5. In the way wherein I have walked, they have privily laid a snare for me. So previously he's been talking about what he felt like, hasn't he? My spirit was overwhelmed. But now he goes on to talk about what they are doing. And often in the Psalms, it's helpful to think in terms of these three parties. There's me, and there's God. Well, we should do that the other way around, shouldn't we? We should put God at the top. There's God, and there's me, and there's they, there's them, the enemies. And, in some psalms there are only two of those three players, but in most of the lament psalms, there's all three. There's God, there's me, and there's my enemies. And sometimes, my enemies are seeking my life, and so I pray to God to deliver me from my enemies. Sometimes it's the wickedness of the wicked, of the they, that is upsetting me and that is impacting my own faith, and so I ask God to step in and to do something about it. So the interaction between these three parties is an interesting dynamic that it's useful to think about. So here is Saul then and his armies. In the way wherein I have walked, they have privily laid a snare for me. I looked on my right hand, and behold, and there was no man that would know me. Refuge failed me. No man cared for my soul. So this aloneness that he feels, this isolation, this estrangement, cut off from normal society. And as we say, perhaps this was when David first fled and the number of people with him was relatively few at this point. And so he feels isolated. And of course you can feel isolated when you're in a crowded room as well, can't you? You can feel like you're the only one who is feeling that way. And everybody else seems to be doing just fine. And yet I feel so wretched. And the psalm expresses that, doesn't it? I looked on my right hand. He looks around him at the men with him. And there was no man that would know him. There was no one who really understood what he was going through. And sometimes it can be that even our marriage partner might not quite understand what it is that we're feeling and that we're struggling with. With particular emotions or conditions that we might have. Refuge failed me. No man cared for my soul. And sometimes other people want to care and they're trying to help, but somehow they don't quite know how to do it because they're not us and they don't know just what it feels like, do they? Notice he doesn't say, no man cared for me. He says, no man cared for my soul. What's the difference between those two? It's like, well, of course, it's not an immortal soul, but what he's doing by using the word soul there is it's like my inner self. No one really gets me, who I really am, what I'm really going through just now. And so he turns to God and says, I cried to thee, O Lord. I said, thou art my refuge and my portion in the land of the living. God is the only one that he can turn to, the only one who really knows him. And then the plea comes back, attend to my cry, for I am brought very low. Deliver me from my persecutors, for they are stronger than I. Bring my soul out of prison, that I may praise thy name. And then this expression of confidence at the end, and it's quite brief, isn't it? But it's there. The righteous shall compass me round about, for thou shalt deal bountifully with me. So he feels so abandoned and alone, and yet he has this belief that the righteous ultimately will compass him round about. And there's a little scene in 1 Samuel 22 right at the start of it. We won't go there and look. But, you know, when David's family and other people come to be with him in the cave, and I wonder if that little phrase at the end of the psalm reflects that time when, you know, he thinks there are so few of them. And then suddenly, you know, by dribs and drabs, the stragglers start to arrive. And he realizes he's not so alone as he thought he was. And, you know, we think about Elijah's, or God's words to Elijah, that he'd reserved all those men and women who had not bowed their knees to Baal, even when Elijah thought that he was the only one. One last thing from this psalm. Would you just have a look through again? There are three sentences or phrases in the psalm. Most of the psalm is about me, isn't it? It's about I and how I feel. But there are three sentences in the psalm where the subject is God that begin with the word thou. Would you perhaps draw a box around each of those? So what's the first one? Then thou knewest my path. What's the second one? Thou art my refuge and my portion in the land of the living. And the third one? Thou shalt deal bountifully with me. And so in the midst of all this darkness, and you can imagine a huge thundercloud hanging over David, can't you? And yet there are these three shafts of light that shine through. And each of them is an expression of confidence, isn't it? So the confidence part isn't all gathered together in one particular place of the psalm. Instead, the psalm is punctuated by these three expressions of hope and light in the midst of all the darkness. Let's just briefly think about each one. When my spirit was overwhelmed within me, then thou knewest my path. Now, isn't that a wonderful thing? When there was more than we could cope with, when it was all too much, when we had lost our way, when we were starting to forget who we were and what our purpose was and what direction we were supposed to be going in, whether there was any point to any of it, then, in that situation, in the depth of that despair, David asserts, Lord, you knew my path even then. Even when I'd lost my own path, Lord, you knew what it was. Now, isn't that a great thing? And, you know, if there are those of us who have struggled with depression, or those of us who are going through very difficult circumstances that we're struggling to cope with, this assertion of David here, that even when we don't know who we are ourselves, even when we seem to be losing the way, that God is still there, even at those times. That he's still watching, and that he still cares, and that he knows our path, and that he can help us to find it again. Now, it may take years to find it again, but he can help us do it. And that's exactly what David asks him to do. What about the second one? I cried unto thee, O Lord, when I was alone, when there was no man and no man cared for my soul. And I said, thou art my refuge and my portion in the land of the living. So do you see that the cave walls that seemed so confining of David, he now actually realizes that they represent God. It's God who is his refuge. The cave is actually protecting him from Saul. And God is his refuge. And God is his portion. Now that's a strange image, isn't it? And probably not one that we would use today, really. But and some of the modern translations paraphrase, and I think it's a fair paraphrase of you are my everything, you are all that I need, you are what is allotted to me, and if I have you, what else matters, really? Does it really matter that Saul is seeking my life if I have a relationship with God? It actually doesn't matter as much as it seemed to matter once I realized that that's the case, because the most important thing in the world I have, and no man can take that away from me. Because when he saw that there was no man, when no man cared for my soul, his own right arm brought salvation for me so that I could be in that special relationship with God. And finally, the expression right at the end of the psalm, thou shalt deal bountifully with me. How about that for an expression of confidence with which the psalm can close? We're going to look at two further psalms, and the next one is on page 5, Psalm 70. Now let's have a look at the start and the end and see what we notice. They're pretty similar, aren't they? Yeah? And that's right. That's right. Imperative verbs. Yep, there they are. Make haste, O God, to deliver me. Make haste to help me, O Lord. Hurry up, Lord. Don't leave it too long. I'm only hanging on by a thread here. If you leave it much longer, it might be too late. And then at the end of the psalm, that's expanded, those ideas. You know, do you remember how we looked at parallelism and we said the second one was always or usually an intensification of it? Well, that's the case here, isn't it? At the end of the psalm, we have a slight intensification of what's there at the beginning. But I am poor and needy. That's why I need you to hurry up, Lord. Make haste unto me, O God. Thou art my help and my deliverer. O Lord, make no tarrying. So we've got, O God, O Lord, haven't we, at the beginning and the end, we've got the reference to making haste, the reference to God as a deliverer, the reference to help. It's all there, linking the beginning and end of the psalm. And that's the plea, isn't it? That's the plea of what we would wish God to do. Now, what about what's in the middle of the psalm? So lines 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7. What do we notice about them? They all begin with let. So these are the justives again, aren't they? Let them be ashamed and confounded. Let them be turned backward. Let them be turned back. Let all those that seek thee rejoice. And let such as love thy salvation say continually, let God be magnified. Now, there's a little something interesting going on there, isn't there? Because all those lets are about what I want to happen to my enemies, aren't they? Until the last one. And then in the last one, the perspective changes, and now it's let God be magnified. And actually, that's more important, isn't it? So there's a movement here from focusing on them to, at the end, focusing on God. Now, just staying with those lines, those let lines, we've got some other interesting things going on, because we've got a couple of words that are used twice, which make a contrast between. Do you notice that the first three lines are about the enemies, aren't they? Let them be ashamed, let them be turned backward, let them be turned back. And the next two lines are about the righteous. Let all those that seek thee, and let such as love thy salvation say, let God be magnified. So actually the progression is from let them the enemies, let them the righteous, let God be magnified. Do you notice any contrast between what's said about the enemies and what's said about the righteous? What about the word seek? Let them be ashamed and confounded that seek after my soul. Do you see the word seek anywhere else? Let all those that seek thee rejoice. Right? So there's a contrast, isn't there? There's a contrast between those who seek other people's souls for negative purposes and between those who seek God. What about the next line? Let them be turned backward and put to confusion that desire my hurt. Now, the word desire doesn't occur, but a similar word occurs. What word is that? Love. Let such as love thy salvation. So there's a contrast between those who desire David's hurt and those who love God's salvation. And there's one final contrast, which I think is the most powerful of all. Let them be turned back for a reward of their shame that say, aha, aha. Now there's something else about saying. What is that? Let such as love thy salvation say continually, let God be magnified. So each of those words, seek, desire, and say, we see two perspectives there, don't we? There are those who seek God, and there are those who seek other people's downfall. There are those who desire God's salvation or love God's salvation, and there are those who desire other people's hurt. There are those who say, let God be magnified, and there are those who say, aha, aha. Now, that's quite a contrast, isn't it? And I've never actually met anyone who says, aha, aha, quite like that. But we know what it means, don't we? This is like Schadenfreude, isn't it? Isn't that the word? The rejoicing in other people's downfall or other people's misfortune. Now, have you ever experienced that? Now, I suspect that some of us will have experienced just having a little glow of feeling good because, you know, something's happened to someone that we didn't really like, or they've had their comeuppance, or they're paying now for what they did. That sort of thing. Is there in any of us the thing that sort of looks down on other people and that somehow enjoys or derives satisfaction from other people's misfortune? So this psalm, of course, is about evil people, but it's also an exhortation about, well, what is our focus on? Really, and we're not here to focus on other people, are we? And to say, aha, aha, but instead to say, let God be magnified, and to ensure that all our lives are lived with that purpose, that God should be glorified in the things that we do and say, and in the things that we think, crucially. Well, let's turn to our final psalm, and it's a very familiar one. It's Psalm 51. And this isn't on the sheet, so this is one for you. You're either expected to know this from memory or to look in your Bible. I'm looking in my Bible. And we're going to look at the first 9 verses. Have mercy upon me, O God, according to thy loving kindness. According to the multitude of thy tender mercies, blot out my transgressions. So this is a psalm about David's sin with Bathsheba, isn't it? It tells us that in the title, when Nathan the prophet came to him and told his parable and said, thou art the man. And we're just going to look through these verses and note down a few words that are used. So people do say that. So what did we just read? We read, have mercy upon me, according to the multitude of thy tender mercies, blot out my transgressions. So I'm just going to put, I'm just going to put the word blot there. Blot out my transgressions. Let's carry on into verse 2. Wash me thoroughly from mine iniquity and cleanse me from my sin. So we're going to just note down here now the idea of wash me. Wash me. And then, so it said, wash me from my iniquity and cleanse me from my sin, didn't it? So we've got three verbs here, haven't they? These are part of the plea, aren't they? Right? Blot out my sin, wash me, cleanse me. And these, of course, are the words that we sung, aren't they, in our opening hymn, and we're going to sing them again in our concluding hymn. Let's go into verse 3. For I acknowledge my transgressions, and my sin is ever before me. So instead of writing the word acknowledge, I'm just going to keep it a bit simpler and write the word know. And I'm not going to have space. So I'm going to do all that again. Sorry about this. Going to have to say aha again in a minute. Yeah. It's in my hand. Aha. Right, so we've got blot, wash. Oh dear. Cleanse. No. And then it says in verse 4, against thee only have I sinned and done this evil in thy sight. So we've got the word sin now, then, haven't we? And what we've done is we've picked out all the verbs, the key verbs from each of these sentences that David has said. So it starts off with asking God to blot out, to wash, to cleanse. And then, so that's about God, and then this is about David, isn't it? I know, I acknowledge my sin, and I have sinned before thee. Now then it says something else. It says, that thou mightest be justified when thou speakest, and be clear when thou judgest. So we're just going to call that. Okay? Let's carry on. Against thee only have I sinned and done evil in thy sight. So do you notice he uses the word sinned again? Against thee only have I sinned and done evil in thy sight. That thou mightest be justified when thou speakest, and be clear when thou judgest. Verse 5. Behold, I was shapen in iniquity, and in sin did my mother conceive me. Verse 6. Behold, thou desirest truth in the inward parts, and in the hidden part, thou shalt make me to know wisdom. In the hidden part, what word are we looking for here? We're looking for the word know, aren't we? In the hidden part, thou shalt make me to know wisdom. verse 7. Purge me with hyssop, and I shall be clean. Are we looking for that? Yes, we are. Purge me with hyssop, and I shall be clean. Wash me. Are we looking for that? Yeah. Wash me, and I shall be whiter than snow. Make me to hear joy and gladness, that the bones which thou hast broken may rejoice. Hide thy face from my sins, and blot out all my iniquities. We're looking for that, aren't we, as well? Now, that, again, is technically, that's called a chiasm. But what it is, we've got A, B, C, D, E, F, E, D, C, B, A, haven't we? It's harder to go backwards, just discovered. Now, that's quite an elaborate pattern, isn't it? It's beautiful, isn't it? It's pretty. You know, it's like getting a flower and looking at it under a microscope, and you can see the flower and you can appreciate it, and you can appreciate the psalm on the surface, of course, but when you look under the microscope, you say, actually, there's something quite interesting going on under the surface there. And it doesn't matter if you don't see this. You can still understand the psalm perfectly well without any of this, can't you? But it's just another dimension to what it's doing. And another interesting thing is that all this is effectively about me and my sin and what I need God to do about it. But in the middle, there is this part, which is verse 4. Now, is that about me and my sin? It's not, is it? Stands apart. Who is it about? It's about God and his righteousness. Now, as we said in an earlier session, when we have these structures like this, often the point is what comes in the middle. You know, we talked about frames. This is a really elaborate frame, isn't it? It's a really elaborate frame. This whole thing is 9 verses long. And you see, it's like an arrow, isn't it? It's like an arrow that's pointing to the center. And what is the center? That thou mightest be justified when thou speakest, and be clear when thou judgest. Now, what that's about then is the righteousness of God, isn't it? So the real topic here is not my sin. My sin is just something that gets in the way, isn't it? My sin is just something that has to be dealt with, that's displeasing to God and needs to be put away and expunged in some manner. But the real point, the reason why we're here, is not so much because we're sinners, but because God is righteous. And we're here to proclaim the righteousness of God. And the atonement is about the righteousness of God, isn't it? More than it's about our sin. Of course, dealing with our sin is, you know, is part of what it does. But fundamentally, it proclaims the righteousness of God. Now, you know, do we find a counterpart for that in the New Testament? You know, is that right, what we've just said? Well, of course it is, because that's exactly the point that Paul makes in Romans 3, isn't it? To declare, I say at this time, his righteousness, that he might be just and the justifier of him who believes in Jesus. And Paul is picking up the language here from Psalm 51. And the very part that Paul quotes in Romans 3 and verse 4, guess which part it is that he quotes? It's this bit right in the middle, isn't it? So Paul, you know, I mean, whether, I don't know whether Paul, you know, enjoyed this little pattern here. I don't know. But he certainly got the point of the passage, didn't he? He understood that the whole thing was about God's righteousness, about God being just and the justifier of him who believes in Jesus. And you see how really all these psalms that we've been considering, and let's just finish now, actually, and not talk about the rest of Psalm 51. All these psalms that we've been considering, each in their own way, they all serve to magnify God, don't they? And to say to us, it's not about you and it's not about me, it's about him. He is the one. He is the great God. And it's his righteousness that we have come to celebrate and to praise.